Log Talk Radio.
On the Edge, real talk about real issues.
Welcome to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett. Oh boy, happy Tuesday, everybody. We are still dealing with the aftermath of the snow, and as it appears, we're supposed to be getting more. So I don't know how Mother Nature is going to be doing this, but to those of you that have to move around in this mush, be safe, be warm, get home safely, make sure that you avoid other people being silly in this bad weather. All right, so thanking God for another day of being here. I want to thank every single one of you who have now brought us up to 21,765 people that are listening out there. I want to thank every one of you that have been actively involved with bringing me topics and suggestions and problems, solutions, everything. I want to thank you for that. So I want to make a announcement, and I want to say to our newest KBA Publicist Agency client, and also someone that you have heard here more than once, Mr. Derico, congratulations for winning your slot on the Unsigned 201 Tour. For those of you that don't know what that is a group that deals with unsigned talent of all areas and fields. And he was entered into it, and through a lot of votes and people supporting him, he actually won a slot. So congratulations, Derico. All right, our shout-outs to Barry Mason, formerly of 98.7 KISS FM Radio. In New York City, currently with iFloRadio.com, you can hear Barry do his thing on Saturdays from 7 to 10 p.m., again on Sundays from 6 to 10 p.m. When he's not doing that, he's gracing New York with the best of live R&B events in the best of venues as the CEO of Track One Entertainment Company. To those of you that have been listening in, there was a what we like to call the local American Idol type competition, the So You Think You Can Sing 2014. We had some wonderful people that were on that panel auditioning and doing their thing with their songs. Whitney Houston was the honorary tributee that they gave an honor to in light of the fact that that day was the second anniversary of her death. And you heard right here on Sunday, you heard Stephanie J. Note, who was the winner, and you heard one of the contestants who did not win, Ms. Renee Steadman. Both were fantastic, fantastic contestants on the show. So I want to thank all of you that did listen in and help with that. To my team, Lady Diamond, Elaine Nieves, Monster Miles, DJ Domerica, Rodney Williams, and, of course, last but certainly not least, that awesome panelist out in awesome activist, let me say that again, Tika Zetti Williams of Toledo, Ohio, who has been an active and intricate part of what the show is today. So tonight, everybody, we are going to be speaking on what everybody's been buzzing about, and that is the Michael Dunn verdict in the murder of Jordan Davis. And all of you know that coming off of the Trayvon Martin trial, definitely, the verdict is sort of bittersweet to the African-American community. Now, tonight, we're going to have two special guests, one that is a former Florida prosecutor. You also have heard his name float around OTE quite a bit because he is one of our sponsors, and he has been on the commercial, which you will hear as we go into the early break before the discussion gets started, Mr. Kenneth Foote. I am happy and honored that he is gracing our presence tonight because I know that there are plenty of things that he could be doing and has to be doing, and he's taking the time out to grace the panel tonight to offer his legal expertise and give some explanation onto what we might find to be outrageous and crazy and inexplicable. On the other front, we're going to have our wonderful expert on African-American cultural research. He's a professor out in Harcum College in Pennsylvania. You have heard him quite often as a guest as well as a panelist, giving his insight and feedback to all of these things that we have been discussing on the show's social issues level, and that is Professor Carlton Jones, and I want to thank him very much for honoring me with the decision to come on and be a guest tonight. So we will be hearing from both of these gentlemen, possibly having both two different sides of the fence here. But either way, we're going to be speaking about it. Now, going out with our, let me shout out a couple of other people because it's important. My social media groups, the On the Edge Listeners Lounge, you guys have been awesome in support and topic discussions, input to the Black Love and Conversations group. Thank you very much, Ms. Linda Miller, for being the moderator of that plateau. I want to thank the Real World Black News and Discussions Group, Black History Suppress, and Higher Research Institute and the Capitalist End Groups, because all of you have been completely phenomenal in supporting me high up there to the mountaintop. So thank you all very much. Now, we are going to go out today with a little bit of nostalgia. We're going to grace your ears with the sound of Earth, Wind, and Fire September. After that, a word from our sponsors, and we will get the show started. So don't go away and keep it locked right here with Katie. Be back in a few.
Like it. You figure that out when you find yourself in a bit of trouble while vacationing or visiting in Florida. And Florida cops are sure as heck not like New York City cops. You're feeling more than put out or simply just confused with it all. But you want justice, You need it to be right, and you want someone who understands where you're coming from. You need Kenneth Foote, attorney at law. Graduate of St. John's University and Florida Stetson University, he'll make sure you're back on track and everything's straightened away. Driving violations, personal injury, drug charges, he's here to work with you as well as for you. Leave nothing to chance. K.L. Foote, attorneys at law, 877-90-FOOTE or klfoote.com. Kenneth Foote, the New Yorker to contact in Florida.
Now, back with more On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge, to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett. Okay, we are going to be discussing the verdict of the Michael Dunn case. You guys all know him. He's the killer of Jordan Davis, the young African-American teen that was gunned down after a loud music dispute in a convenience store parking lot. And one of the things that has been happening is the African-American community has been up in arms because after what we consider the fiasco of the George Zimmerman verdict and feeling that a young teen's life was taken and no justice was served, we are now faced with what we all feel is something that should have been a lot more in our mind, justice serving, and that is that he should have been convicted of first-degree murder. Okay, now, many of aspects of this situation and the controversy that's coming up is definitely the race card. The race card is definitely up on the table, and a lot of us don't understand the semantics of what goes on with jury selection and jury decisions and deliberating and all that other stuff, which is why our guest tonight is going to try to shed some light on that. We also are going to discuss why it is that race seems to be such a big issue. And one of the things that we are going to be asking is, do we believe, because that also came up in the discussions, do we believe that this was just Florida giving us a bit of a token breadcrumb, as I like to refer to it, to keep us quiet because there was such an outrage over the Zimmerman trial? And do we feel, these are the two questions that was requested of me to ask, do we feel that with the first-degree murder charge having been declared a mistrial, despite the other convictions, will this be yet another way that once there's a new trial, if there should be one, in an appeal, that there's a possibility that this man may walk anyway, because the first-degree murder trial, if they go back to it, you know, somehow, some way, there's going to be some technical loophole that brings him out back onto the streets. That is it. So let's bring our panelists in and see who we have on the line today. Welcome to the show, Callie. You're on the air. Hello?
Hi, Katie. It's Kenneth Foote in Florida. Can you hear me?
Hi. Welcome, Kenneth. How are you? Okay, I'm going to bring panelists in up the floor first, okay? So just give me 1 second.
Okay.
All right. Welcome to the show, Callie. You're on the air.
Good evening, Lady Barnett. And how is everyone? Hi. God bless everyone on the panel and the guests also and their families.
Thank you very much, Deacon. 1 second. I'll bring in our other three panelists. Welcome to the show, Callie. You're on the air.
Katie, hey Deacon,
hey.
And our
Hi,
other panel.
All right, welcome DC. Hold on 1 second. Welcome to the show, Callie. You're on the air.
Hey Katie, this is Carlos Ellaby Jones, aka Stalo Jenkins.
Hello, Stalo. 1 second, and our final panelist.
All right.
Welcome to the show, Callie. You're on the air. Hello. Okay. All right, Kenneth, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for taking out time from your busy schedule to grace my panel this evening. And you heard actually my intro. We definitely know this is what's considered a high-profile case. It's been all over the place. And one of the things that is a concern is why did the verdict go the way that it did when clearly this man's actions seem to warrant a higher charge. So let's start with that.
Well, Katie, in a jury room, no one knows exactly what's going on. That's one of the little secrets that is there. No one ever knows what's going on in a jury deliberation room unless those jurors come out and voluntarily talk to us and tell them what they had a problem with. What we do know from the 12 jurors that obviously someone believed that Michael Dunn was defending himself and in fear of his life. And on the other side, there were people that believed that he should have been convicted, and that's why there was a hung jury. In any jury, there has to be a decision that's made by all 12 jurors. They have to reach the same decision. And so you have 12 people with 12 different backgrounds that all have to come to the same verdict and agree on that verdict. If they cannot do that, then the judge would declare a mistrial as to that particular count.
Okay, I appreciate that input because there's a lot of things. There's no way to avoid comparing Jordan Davis's trial to Zimmerman's trial because pretty much the players on the board are practically similar. And it's definitely, you know, an older white man dealing with an African American teen. It was pretty much a senseless situation. Now, the one thing that I need to ask, because I had three questions of my own, was could you please explain to me and to my listeners exactly what the Stand Your Ground law is, what it entails, and does it apply to everyone in the state of Florida?
Well, all laws apply to every citizen of the state of Florida or anyone that's visiting in our state. Pretty much the Stand Your Ground law is active in about 15 or 16 states in some version around the country. In Florida, when there is violence toward a person, you have the right to defend yourself. And traditionally for years, we've had something called the Castle Doctrine, and the Castle Doctrine says that if someone breaks into your home, you don't have to run away from your home. You have a right to stand your ground and defend yourself in your home. That was extended to a motor vehicle. If someone comes to your motor vehicle, the same thing. With the Stand Your Ground law, what it pretty much says is that you don't have to retreat from anyone. If you reasonably believe that your life is in danger, that you can use deadly force to prevent yourself or someone else from being harmed. Before the Stand Your Ground law, if you were out in the street and someone threatened you, if you had the ability to retreat, the law required that you would have to go and run away from the person if you were able to do so. What Stand Your Ground law does is it says that you don't have to run away anymore. The same law that applies in your home, if someone were to break into your home, applies anywhere outside, even on the street. And so, therefore, that law is applicable to everyone if they believe that they are reasonably in fear. The key words in those jury instructions is that, in this case, Michael Dunn or anyone else, Zimmerman, they have to believe that they were reasonably in fear of imminent death or serious bodily harm. And so it's something that's called the reasonable person standard. If someone else, a reasonable person, were in Mr. Dunn's shoes, would he have done the same thing? And that's the standard that the jury has to deal with to determine whether or not it was reasonable. Were his actions reasonable?
Okay. I'm going to actually touch back on that, but I want to get these other two questions out.
Oh,
and then
boy.
One of the things, the next thing I would like to ask is this. There was so much evidence in that case, you know, that would have, well, to the rest of us, appeared to be necessary to present, but yet it was either dismissed or not presented. And I'll give you a few examples. Definitely the fact that Mr. Dunn was intoxicated, like beyond belief. And not only that, he left the scene of the crime after shooting at the children or whatever. He left to get more alcohol, was at a hotel, didn't report the crime till the next day or whatever it was. Then there was the fact that there was talk of racist letters that were being, you know, sent out by him from jail. And then there was the fact that there was an eyewitness who was actually a police officer that was at the scene that saw what happened and actually wasn't saying anything in Michael Dunn's favor. Why weren't, well, what, was it strategy or some sort of, I guess, strategic planning on the part of either side of the prosecution and defense table that this wasn't presented? Because it actually does seem like it's relevant evidence.
Well, Katie, that's a good question. As you know, I was a former criminal prosecutor down in the Clearwater area in Tampa Bay and handled very serious crimes like this, including murder. And the prosecutors have to decide what they think the evidence should be presented to the jury to make their case. And as it indicates, if you could watch one of these trials on Court TV, you'll see the commentators talk about other evidence that the jury doesn't get to hear. Now, I looked into the issue with regard specifically to the letters, and the letters themselves were written while Mr. Dunn was awaiting trial, while he was in custody. He wrote them to family members, and the letters are a little disturbing. If you go on to the Jacksonville newspaper there, they actually provide those to the public. And I was concerned about the letters and the nature of the letters, but it looked like he was responding to his situation, speaking about, you know, they definitely had racial overtones in the letter. Now, normally, if some evidence is inflammatory or unfair to the defense, they can ask the judge to not allow the prosecutors to put that evidence in. And I reviewed the case file in this case, and it looked like that there was no such motion to keep these letters out. So it was a choice on part of the state attorney's office not to introduce these letters. I can tell you that's a little troubling to me because I think it was important for the jury to hear. But if you remember the Trayvon Martin case, the same prosecutors who handled that case stated that they did not want to try the case on race. And I believe they did the same thing in this case, that they did not want to try the case on the issue of race. They just wanted to put the evidence out there. And I believe they made a tactical decision not to introduce those letters or present them to Mr. Dunn when he took the stand to testify. With regard to the other issues, in intoxication and him not making reports to the police, that's what we call consciousness of guilt. In my opinion, if a person takes off after shooting into a vehicle and goes home and orders a pizza and takes his dog to the vet or whatever they said he did, that's disturbing. And obviously, the prosecutor did bring that out, that he did not call the police. And as far as intoxication, I don't know what they brought up about intoxication, if anything, but as a prosecutor, I might not want to bring that up because a jury might want to excuse his behavior if they thought he was impaired by alcohol, even though that's not a legal standard. You voluntarily get drunk and do something that's a crime, you're still going to get convicted. So a lot of these decisions were tactical decisions on the part of the prosecutor's office in bringing their case. But I can tell you this, prosecutors are very careful about what they bring out in evidence. They try not to do overkill because if there's a conviction, the defense has a lot of reasons to appeal the case and say that the prosecutors acted improperly, they shouldn't have brought this evidence in, and the appeals court could overturn a conviction. So it may be that they obviously didn't want to continue to hit the nail on the head and have splinters flying by adding some extra things. But with regard to the letters, in my opinion, as a former prosecutor, I thought those letters should have been brought out to the jury because it's obvious that race played a part in this case.
I was just about to say that. I'm going to bring, before I bring him in, I want to kind of address that as well because you said that they didn't want to try the case on race. But clearly, I mean, listen, everything about the case was racially motivated. Everything about it. It wasn't just the loud music. This man said things. His letters, you know, proved it later. The way that he acted, the dismissive way he was, you know, he was comfortable telling blatant lies in the investigation, even with the police that were interrogating him, pretty much letting him know they didn't believe his story either. But he is the situation. Well, I guess I'm glad to say that the judge didn't buy the self-defense situation, but here is the thing. You say the stand your ground law is for everybody, and I believe that's what it's supposed to be. But for those people that are questioning or believing that it's a racial situation, think about all the other people that was in that state that went through things of that were African American that did not get the same type of luxuries. We're talking about Marissa Alexander, a mother that had every right to defend herself. She just had a baby. She had a ex-husband that was under a restraining order who came after her. She ran into a garage, got a gun, and shot one warning shot in the air, and she went to jail for 20 years. And the only reason why there's a little of a reprieve was because the George Zimmerman trial was similar to the same thing, and the same blanket defense or whatever the case was supposed to apply in that case. She had way more rights based on the content of her situation to shoot at this man, and she shot in the air. She caused nobody any harm. No one was hurt. She tried to scare this man away from her, and she had a restraining order in the state of Florida in place. So she got 20 years to life, and in addition to that, they didn't just dismiss her case after reviewing it. They said she has to await another trial so that it looks like they're trying to give the appearance of fairness. That's one. Two, let's talk about another young man that was a former airman, okay, young father of three, okay? He was in a club or a bar, all right? There was a fight that broke out. He was not part of it, all right? But he was in the middle, in the vicinity of the struggle and the tussling. He had friends that he attended to a place with, went into his vehicle, got a gun that he had a permit for, came back into the club, not to shoot anybody, but just to have it for protection. What turned out to happen? Now, when he got in there, those people fighting attacked him. And while he was on the floor getting punched in the face, he shot his attacker in the leg. Okay? He went to jail for 25 years away from his family, dishonorably discharged from his branch of the military, which means that any type of benefits the military offer to his family in light of his absence is not going to be granted to them. And he went to jail. Let's talk about how Trayvon Martin pretty much was walking away from this man and stood his ground when this stranger that was coming on him was attacking him. And it seemed like based on all the different testimonies that were coming around and altered and changed around, that it wasn't George Zimmerman that was on trial. It was Trayvon's character as a weed-smoking teen. It was Rachel Johnteel, who couldn't speak English. It was people laughing and joking, including the own defense attorney's daughter, who was on Instagram making fun of them, saying we're celebrating Idiots Week with an ice cream cone. No one sat up there and blew them up about that. Matter of fact, this happened on a Friday when the trial resumed on Monday. Not one person chastised the Rick Rest for his daughter doing that crap. So as much as Florida Stand Your Ground law is supposed to apply, why is it that it only seems it applies to certain people?
Well, Katie, I can tell you this. There are statistics out there that show that Stand Your Ground, and I don't have exact numbers, but I believe at least 26 young people have died since this law has been enacted. And there have been over 100 shootings where a person claimed to stand your ground. And the facts are the facts that minorities are convicted when they claim stand your ground, and whites who have black victims seem to get away with it statistically. And that's one of the issues, although people say that race is not a part of it. As a criminal defense attorney now, that's what I do now, and being on the other side as a prosecutor, I think that these issues are very important because they explain the makeup of what's in the mind of a person when they decide to pull a gun out. We've all heard the story, where if a white woman is in an elevator and two black men come in, she clutches her purse. You know, it is ingrained in the minds of some people, okay, by teaching and upbringing, that if you see black men standing on a corner, based on what music is playing and how they're dressed, that they can be a threat to you. So in their minds, they believe that these individuals could pose a threat even if they don't pull out a weapon. And so somehow, based on your jury, if you have white people on the jury who feel the same way, they're going to acquit the person because they think about, if I was in the situation, I saw four black men, I'd probably be nervous and scared too. And the result of the Stand Your Ground law shows disproportionately that minorities cannot use that defense or don't have great results with that defense as opposed to whites. So you're exactly correct. And with the young airman, I had just learned about that case, and that's a tragic case. That's a young man who served his country, deployed two times overseas. He's just at a party, and he goes to look for his friends, and he shot the guy in the leg. But in Florida, we have the 10-20 life statute with regard to guns. If you pull a gun out, you're going to do 10 years. If you shoot that gun, you're going to do 20. And if you hit a person, you can do 25 to life under the 10-20 life. So the young lady who was prosecuted by this very same prosecutor for trying to scare off her husband during domestic violence, because there was a child in the room, the prosecutors decided under the law she should get the minimum mandatory sentence for firing a gun, okay? But I'll give you an update. Recently, the legislature now, in looking at Stand Your Ground because of the national outcry, is trying to pass a new part of the law to say that warning shots are allowed, okay, in an attempt to try to, you know, stop the killings. When you think about it, if you shoot the gun and don't hit a person or you miss them, you're going to be facing a lot of time in prison. But if you shoot and kill them, you probably got a good defense for Stand Your Ground because you were in fear. And that's the problem with the law, is that, you know, if you shoot a gun, you're definitely going to prison. But if you hurt someone, you kill someone like Trayvon Martin, you get acquitted. But if you shoot a warning shot, like the young lady did in the same prosecutor's office, you'll get 20 years. So there's definitely a problem with the law.
Okay, thank you so much. There is another guest that I want to bring in, and panelists, I want you all to just hang your ground. You'll get your chance to ask questions. Let me bring the other two that are waiting in, and I'm going to go to our other guest for tonight. Hold on one second. Welcome to the show, Cole. You're on the air.
Hello, this is Professor Carl Tone Jones.
Hello, hi. Professor.
All right, I'm just making sure I was off mute this time. So, you know, I'm listening to the show, and thank you, brother, for definitely giving us the legalese of this case and the Stand Your Ground law in Florida. Some of the things that I'm hearing, although very truthful for what you're saying, they're troubling to hear. You know, it's troubling to hear that based on a person's opinion, someone can be justified in killing someone because they have felt that fear themselves. When you talk about the interpretation of the law, you know, we hear that the interpretation when it's describing juries, that juries go into the jury box and they deliberate on the case, and they're supposed to just deliberate with the facts involved as they pertain to the law. But we all know that personal experiences influence how we see these facts. And the fact that Sister Shahrazad Ali was on the Dr. Drew show tonight, and she brought up a very interesting point. How is it that there were no black male jurors on either one of these cases? Now, I know that to be a part of the jury selection pool, you have to be registered voters, but I'm pretty sure in both of these towns that there were black men who were registered voters who may have been eligible for this case, for these cases, and I'm trying to figure out how that was not possible. Now, you did touch on something earlier with the statistics, and I'll give you the numbers. 73% of the people get off of or never face trial due to Stand Your Ground when the perpetrator or whomever they're shooting is black. That's straight out of the Jacksonville Times. So, you know, we need to figure out the social ramification of these cases, because what's happening now is the value of our children's lives is at stake now. The ramification socially is that it seems to be making more people brazen, and I'm talking about the dominant white society here. making them more brazen and buying guns and shooting our children. There was somebody that was just shot over the weekend, if I'm not mistaken, a young brother, Ricardo Sainz, if I'm not mistaken, in Orlando for running through somebody's yard, you know, and the perpetrator, the man who shot him, stated that he shot him because he felt threatened because the young man's pants was down. The young man had left his yard and ran into another apartment complex. He pursued him and still shot him 6 times. So these events are happening more often. I mean, we know about Trayvon. We know about Jordan Davis. And many know about Darius Simmons. But then we also have Everett Gant, and the list goes on. And what we have to figure out, I'm sorry. the list is going, I'm sorry, let me just stop right there for a second. I think somebody's trying to chime in.
No one's trying to chime in. Continue, Professor.
Okay. So to continue to deal with this, how do we address this? I know I have my answers, but I'm curious just to know, how do we address this on a legal standpoint in terms of exacting some justice so that we can prevent more Trayvons, more Jordans, more Darius's, more Everett's, more Ricardo's? How can we prevent that? Because right now it's open season on our children.
Well, Professor, if I may, if I can respond. With regard to the question with the jury pool, in Florida, the requirement is not that you're a registered voter. You only have to have a driver's license. That's how they pick jurors in the state of Florida. You don't have to be a registered voter. It's driver's licenses. So that makes your question even a little more valid with regard to the jury pool. But when a case like this comes up, they'll have 100 to 150 people standing by to be selected, and the prosecutors get to pick who they want and dismiss who they want, and the defense has a certain number of people they can pick and who they can dismiss. And with this jury makeup, I don't have the exact numbers, but there were women and men. There were black women. There were Latin. There was Latino women. I think there was an Asian and a white male. And so for various reasons, if the prosecutor or the defense picks a minority to get thrown off the jury, they actually have to give the judge what we call a race-neutral reason why you are getting rid of a particular person. But that's traditionally if the defendant is a minority. So say if the defendant was black and you keep getting rid of all the black people, you have to explain why you're getting rid of these people. Is there a legal reason why you're getting these people off the jury? So it's a good question that you have. I don't know who was in the pool. I would assume that there were some black men in that jury, but the selection to be a juror in the state of Florida is not based on registered voters. It's just a driver's license. But you do bring up a point, which is what I commented on, that the jury instruction itself states that if the person reasonably believes that they are in fear, so you said it's based on opinion, it's supposed to be a reasonable person standard, which is kind of a gray area. What would a reasonable person do? And we all know that there's some crazy people out there, and they think they're being reasonable. But what confuses me about this verdict is that they found him guilty on 3 counts of attempting to kill somebody but couldn't come to a decision as to actually killing somebody. And what that tells me from my experience, 15 years or so doing this, is that some of those jurors were on the side of Michael Dunn. They thought like him. They believed what he was saying. And I watched some of his testimony, and this man he was not remorseful. He was very cocky with the prosecutors, talking back to them, you weren't there, and all this kind of stuff. But his fiance got on the stand and said, no, he never told me he saw any gun. He never told me he saw any weapon, which killed his testimony, which makes me even more confused as to why the jury couldn't reach a verdict on the murder charge. And that only tells me that there were people on that jury that thought like Michael Dunn, which is a problem, you know, because –
May I chime in? Yes, it does seem like they thought like Michael Dunn, and from the community on the outside standpoint, it seems like they thought like him, like a white person that couldn't stand a black person, didn't like their music. And most of the things that he said, even by his own admission, was, you're not going to talk to me like that. You know, it just seems really, there's really no way to say that this isn't about somebody just blatantly being racist. And it doesn't, it says to me, I'm trying to figure out something you just pointed out, Mr. Foote. You said that, that you know, that they have to present these judges a racially neutral reason. You couldn't possibly explain to me or make me believe that out of six men that could have been in the pool, that all six men or four out of six men had a racially neutral reason not to be selected or to be dismissed. And it's funny that it's only happening in Florida with the Stand Your Ground law.
Yeah. Well, that's if the jurors, no one knows how many people were in the selection process. The selection process can take days. I don't know how many people were in the jury pool to be selected, and I don't know how many people actually got in there and how many were black males. So I can't really speak on that. I gave an example that if you were to start getting rid of minority jurors, okay, then you have to give a race-neutral reason. I don't know what happened in this case as far as black males were concerned, but that's usually the standard.
Okay.
They're really showing you how to care.
Professor, is that you?
No, it wasn't me. I was about to jump in. But
go ahead. Well, no, that was I was just going to address one more thing, Tim, and then I do have to go to the next panel with the panelist for the moment, which is Deacon. Deacon, you'll be up first. You mentioned earlier that some of the evidence that was taken out was a tactical decision. Now, I'm not speaking defense because I know defense will do everything they can to X out anything that can, you know, stack the chips against their client. But I'm not understanding, and maybe you can as a prosecutor, what would make a prosecutor find it a tactically sane decision to throw out something that proved this man had reasons that were not of a self-defense nature, such as you are going to paint him as a racist because he was a racist. You are going to paint him as a drunk because that would heighten the reason why he acted the way he did, especially if he said it was about loud music. He can't hear himself think because he was drunk. And alcohol beyond the capacity of your own body is going to make everything seem twice as loud or twice as messed up. You know, so why would a prosecutor with straight reasons and with no hidden agendas find it a tactically sane decision to throw out the main things that make their case even stronger? And why would it be a thing about not race when it's about race? This is where
I'm in total agreement with you on that. And as a former prosecutor sitting in that chair, having to make decisions on how to present my case, I'm not going to really second guess them on everything. But what gives me some concern is that in the Trayvon Martin case, they did the same thing. You know, they kept saying this is not about race, and they stood up and smiled and when they gave their interview. And everybody knows that that is an issue. And the only reason, remember, in the Trayvon Martin case, that happened in Sanford, Florida. And based on the way that the prosecutors in Sanford handled it and the police, Governor Rick Scott picked a particular prosecutor to handle this case. And my personal opinion about Trayvon Martin's case was that I think they wanted to put on the show to let everyone, especially in the black community, see we're going to really go after this guy and pass it off to the jury. And then when the verdict came out, they said, well, we did our job. I mean, that prosecutor stood up and smiled at the end during her interview. Maybe that's just her personal manner. But she was smiling like this was some fun event. This was a tragic event.
Yeah.
And they made decisions to say, well, no, it's not about race. So the same prosecutor's office, in this case, made the same decision that we don't want to make it about race. And I believe that if race is a fact, that fact should be put in front of the jury for them to consider.
It's a method of intimidation as well. Like, they're trying to intimidate us and render us paralyzed by what they're doing here. Like, if I heard a white woman say earlier that if this had been a reverse situation and a black person killing one of four white people, there would be a riot equal to none if he got acquitted. And this is true. There's a problem going on. We have a confirmation that our condition is urgent. They've given them a license to kill us. And my theory is this, that the Stand Your Ground law was introduced to do exactly what it's doing. It's combating any hate crime legislation that was ever put forth on the federal level, on the state level, anything. Because in this situation, we have a bunch of bigots, killer bigots in the South. These killer bigots in the South want to just be able to kill people. Oh, I snapped and killed somebody. It's not first-degree murder if you just snapped. But if you already hated that person before you even knew him, now we have hate crime law that increases the penalty, increases the years that we should be giving them. However, they introduced Stand Your Ground law to combat race. The racial progress, the progress of equality in the judicial system that we've made to combat that in the South, they have put forth this law and they're using it exactly how they want it to do. And these people and these lawyers, they pussyfooting around while everybody else is remaining silent, ignoring the crying and the weeping for justice. Everybody needs to really, really stand up now.
Okay. Well, I need to go to the panelist that was waiting. So, Deacon, your thoughts on the case?
Well, first of all, I was really appalled by the verdict because it was said that the Stand Your Ground law is you have to feel threatened. Okay, this man was talking about loud music. How did he feel threatened? That's what I don't understand. I can't even see this picture. Oh my goodness! Because this is really an excuse for them to kill our young black men. Now there was an incident there, and I can't recall his name right now because I'm kind of shook up over this thing. But there was a young black man that shot someone, and it had to do with the Stand Your Ground. But now he's doing 25 years, and he's black. And I can't remember, but I know somebody sent it to me on my post, but I lost it. I can't seem to find it. I was say again,
Michael Giles.
Yeah, that's you, Professor.
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah. So, and that's what I don't understand. And they're saying it doesn't have to do with race. This gives the white man the authority to kill more of us. Because for the simple fact, they give more value to a dog's life than they give to a black man's life.
Well, Deacon, that's correct.
Deacon, what we have to understand, too, is we have to understand that there's social engineers involved here that create these laws and these policies. Now, I don't expect – we can't expect normal layman people to understand written law, written precedent that's been put in place. But the people who are the social engineers, I'm talking about the policymakers and the ones who determine what's going on in our society, they understand the writ of law, and they understand the Dred Scott decision. They understand the 13th Amendment. They understand how those laws actually predicate what happens today, and they maintain their laws and policies with laws like Stand Your Ground. And what happens is we continue to live in a situation where we experience cognitive dissonance, where we're trying to be in the system living the American dream and not realizing that we are the traitors to America's nightmare. So what's happening is you have people like Michael Giles, Marissa Alexander, Trevor Dooley, who was attacked by a skateboarder, and he defended himself. And this is a 70-something-year-old man. He was attacked by a 30-year-old man, and he shot this man for attacking him, and he's doing the rest of his life in jail. So, and I believe that also happened in Florida, if I'm not mistaken. So we have to understand that these things are happening, and they're happening for a purpose, and they happen for a reason. There's always an agenda behind legislation. Now,
well, if I can respond to that real quick to what Deacon is saying and you, Professor, you're correct. I saw the young lady in Georgia who's a criminal defense attorney, a white woman, who said that if this were reversed, where black grown black men were killing white teenagers, there'd be riots in the streets. This law would be gone. But with regard to social, the engineering, you have to understand that the NRA, And all these big groups lobby and send millions of dollars and run ads here in Florida and lobby these politicians. We will give you millions of dollars for your election if you put in this law. And it's akin to a modern lynching. Back in the day, you know, if you looked at a white woman or some guy thought that you did something wrong, they could lynch you right there. You didn't call the cops. And today, in some ways, this law is pretty much bringing back, you know, 21st century lynching law. You are able to not call the police, which this man did not do. He went home, ordered a pizza, took care of his dog, didn't call anyone because he felt he did what he – it's normal for him. And to answer, Deacon, your question with regard to the music, he heard the music and asked them to turn it down. They turned it down. And he stated that the young men had words with him, and they said this, you know, stuff is going down tonight, and got get ready to jump out of the car. And that's when the Mr. Dunn felt threatened. So it was the music started the conversation, but the way this man testified, if you watch the testimony, he was looking at everyone like, doesn't everyone agree with me? How dare a black boy, you know, not give me the respect that I deserve? I said, turn the music down. And when they, you know, started countering me and talking back to me, I did what was right. Don't you guys all agree? That's how his testimony came out. So,
may I ask you a question on that? Because that disturbs the hell out of me. It really does. The point was he tried to use self-defense. He said he was in fear of his life. Now that he can get to on the stage, and I'm going to call it a stage, not a testifying altar, but I'm going to say he said he was in fear of his life. Then he turns around now that the Stand Your Ground law wasn't allowed by the judge to be used. Now he said, well, don't you agree with me because it was a black boy that's not doing whatever? And first of all, forensic evidence showed that there was no way he could have been in fear of his life. And what about the obvious fact that he was shooting 10 times at a retreating car? At a retreating car. How could the courts even entertain that?
That's when it becomes a crime. That's when it becomes a crime, Katie. When you fire off that shot and that car starts to drive away, the danger that you're afraid of is going away.
Right.
So he got out of the vehicle, pointed at it, and emptied the rest of his gun toward the fleeing vehicle. That is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
in addition, it was 10 shots. 10 shots. So, obviously, he wasn't in danger any longer. And not only that, he said the guys got out the car and that there was a weapon. He tried everything he could to pad that suitcase.
And this is a question I have real quick. You know, as a prosecutor, now you heard the first witness, the gentleman who said he went into the store and came out and witnessed the entire event, right? And that's the gentleman that said he turned around when he heard Michael Dunn say, you're not going to talk to me like that, and then reach into the glove box and grab the weapon and then turn and unsheath it, cock it, and then turn around and shoot into the car. Now, you have several different factors there that maybe we can get some clarity on. For one, if you have a witness that's standing there and you're the prosecutor, don't you ask that man if he saw that door on that truck ever open, if he's standing there, because this is the time that Michael Dunn claims that Jordan Davis is out of the vehicle right now. Don't you ask that question? And then don't you ask, there was another part too, whereas the fiance acknowledged that they drove past a squad car going to and leaving the gas station that looked like it was on a traffic stop. The lights were still on. Why didn't they stop there if it was a self-defense case? And then third, you have bullets. Who knows what bullets actually killed Jordan Dunn and where the car was when he got killed? Did he get killed when they were pulling away? Because at that point, it's no longer self-defense, right? And if he got shot with the bullets as they were pulling away, then I'm rambling because I have premeditation in my mind from the fact that he reached into the glove compartment and pulled the gun out and shot him. But and I know I rambled on, but if you could just try to make sense of what I just said,
They've been waiting patiently. So go ahead, Ken, please address that.
Well, with regards to the witnesses told the state attorneys and the investigators that Mr. Davis never got out of that car. And the prosecutors argued that. He never got out of that car, and no gun was found. With regards to the stop squad car, why he didn't stop, that's what I said earlier. That is evidence of what we call consciousness of guilt. Okay? Mm-hmm. If you know you did something right, you stop and let the police know. If you think you did something wrong, you go about your business. If you think that you were justified, well, you go home and order a pizza. That's exactly what he just did. But with regard to the bullets that killed Jordan Davis, they were on the side of the car. If you saw the pictures of the car, that car was riddled with bullets. But there's audio of the shots. And you'll hear a burst of three or four shots, and then it gets silent, and then the shots start again. That's when Michael Dunn got out of the car and started aiming down the street like he was in a movie at a police vehicle and continued to shoot. So with regard to premeditation, which people, that is what they think the jury got hung up on, is premeditation. First-degree murder is traditionally what we see on TV where I'm going to kill this person, let me make the plan, let me do this, let me do that. But what people don't understand is that premeditation can take 2 seconds. Once you start shooting because you're in fear and then the person drives away, now you've decided, let me continue shooting because I want to kill. That was enough premeditation that this jury could have come back with a conviction.
Right. One more thing, and then, DC, you're up. I need to ask you this. Now, he was convicted on everything that said attempted murder, but the person died. So my question is, how can they convict on something that was an attempt, but the attempt actually went through?
The attempt was, what they believed was, is that Jordan Davis was the person supposedly that had a gun that he pointed out of the window at Michael Dunn. Therefore, he would have been justified in shooting at Jordan Davis. However, when he keeps shooting at everyone else in the car, that's attempted murder because they ain't threatening you. So you don't have a right to shoot at them. But what hung them up, and Katie, you keep asking the question that I asked as an attorney, how can you find someone guilty of attempting to do something but don't find them guilty when they do it? The issue was that they're trying to wrestle with the fact was this man really in fear of his life of Jordan Davis? That's why they got hung up on, whether or not he was defending himself. But the other people weren't doing anything to him. Therefore, you can't just blindly shoot at everyone because one person is doing something.
But like I said, I'm confused. Doesn't once the victim dies, it becomes murder anyway? Or is that different in Florida?
No, not necessarily, because when you're shooting, I mean, he didn't know that he even hit anybody. His testimony was he shot at the car.
He tried to kill him. There's no way you're going to tell me who shot 10 times without an intent to hit somebody.
Here's what the jury instruction says that the judge reads to them is that, if you believe that Michael Dunn was reasonably in fear of his life, okay, or protecting someone else, so if you see someone, robbing somebody at gunpoint, you can drive by, get out your car, and shoot that person because you're protecting someone else. It doesn't even have to be yourself. That's the law. You can protect someone else or yourself. So the jury was reading, and some of those people believe that Michael Dunn was in fear of his life and that there must have been a gun, even though they didn't find one. So that's why they got hung up on the whole situation.
While the car was moving away, Jim, while the car was moving away, he was in fear of his life. When the car
No, 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 no. That's where they got it wrong. That's where I'm confused. When you start driving, I'll give you the first shot. But when the car's driving away and you get out of your car to aim down the street, that's a crime.
Yes,
and that's
it is.
What I'm asking you. How can the judge instruct the jury do you really believe that he was reasonably in fear of his life once the second shot, third shot, fourth shot was going at a retreating car? How can that even be an option to entertain in deliberation?
The judge doesn't get to pick what to tell the jury like that. If this crime happened up in Pensacola or all the way down in Key West, we all have the same book. It has the same jury instruction.
That seems that's what's happening, though.
It's up to
it
the juror.
It seems the judges are saying that. How can they possibly put that in an option for deliberations if the facts clearly stated that this man shot multiple times at a retreating car?
I agree. But listen to this. This is very important. This is what the national media is getting wrong, too. They're making assumptions. The judge can't pick, you know, how to instruct the jury. If it's a first-degree murder case, the specific instructions that the judges don't pick, the legislatures who voted in this law are the ones who actually go ahead and tell us what jury instructions should be up there. So the judges are pretty much like robots. They get to read what the instruction is for a particular crime. So they have to read what's in the book and what's been passed by law. They don't get to – believe me, let me tell you. Back in the day, the judges had a lot of discretion where if you were in certain counties in Florida, one judge would hang you in 5 minutes, and then another one, the judge would do something else. So everyone cried out, it has to be uniformity. And that's why the instructions are the same for everyone. The judge has to read the self-defense instruction if the defense says that's their defense. My client did this because he was defending himself, so we have to read the instruction. If there's enough evidence out there where you believe this person felt reasonably in fear, you have to acquit him. And some of them believe it.
I guess my question should apply to why would the legislature offer that as an option if the case was as the evidence presented. DC, you're up.
Okay. You guys have touched on a lot, and I'm going to take a second, hopefully, to give my input on all of the areas. First of all, Attorney Foote, I have sat on a capital murder jury. It was not a color issue other than the jury room. And you are right when you say when those doors close and the jury goes into deliberation, it is all over the chart, all right? Although the judge reads instructions, people bring themselves into a jury room. And it depends on what they believe personally as to how they're going to apply the law. In my particular case, there were three African-American defendants accused of killing an African-American man. From my opinion, there was no evidence that put the gun in the hands of the defendants, and their alibis were reasonable. There were three white people on the jury, and of those three that wanted to convict, one said, well, I hear your argument, D.C., but I can't send these boys back to that community after people have testified against them. I was outraged because unless the young men were guilty of the crime that was accused of them, that's not what we're here to do, save the community. We're here to apply the law based on the evidence. So that is my experience with juries. Now, we don't know what happened in this Florida case. We don't know what the jurors brought into that jury room during the deliberation. You know, again, it becomes very personal. It's about your own ideas and how you interpret the instructions and the law, et cetera. All right? Here's the other thing I want to point out. I hope that the coverage of this continuing case, because the Florida State's Attorney says they will re-prosecute for the hung murder count, I hope that the continued discussion does not taint or further taint the jury pool. All right? And the third point I want to make is you guys mentioned the demographics of the jury, and that's all well and fine if it was set up to be that way. But in the jury room I was in during my deliberation, the African-Americans that were there were acquiescing to the pressure placed on them by whites, quote-unquote, that they felt were in authority. So they, in other words, were going to give in and convict these young boys with no evidence. And I will say, D.C. Price hung that case, and they had to retry the boys.
Good for you. Kenneth, before I move on to bringing in our next panelist, let me ask you a question with regard to that, because that is the second question on the table tonight. With the mistrial of the first-degree murder charge, if they should appeal and they should go back in, will it nullify the other convictions?
Well, he's convicted on the other charges, so they're not going to retry those unless they come back on some type of appeal. So the only charge they're going to charge him again on is the first-degree murder charge. The only way they're going to hear the attempted murder and the shooting in the car again is if the appeals court overturns it for some procedural reason out there. And there are a lot of procedural reasons why a case can be overturned. If the prosecutor oversteps their ground or comments on the right to remain silent, or there's a lot of procedural things that attorneys can do that will overturn a case. So keep in mind, if a person is acquitted, the prosecutors don't get to appeal anything. That's double jeopardy. It's over. Not guilty, you go home. But when you're convicted, the defense gets to go through every piece of transcript to find out if the prosecutors overstepped their bounds, and they can appeal the case. So if there is no appeal on the conviction, remember, he got convicted of four, so three attempted second-degree murders and the shooting into the vehicle, that's it. That's over. So if when they try this, it's only going to be the first-degree murder again.
Okay, so the other convictions will stay in place regardless of whether there's a new trial for the first-degree murder.
He's going to be in jail doing time while he works on his appeal and while they decide to get this second case together. But I just wanted to quickly comment on the D.C. He was talking about the personal experiences in the jury room. There's something that I always say in every case when I make a closing statement, and that is, you know, I tell the jurors in these words, there's something that you brought in this courtroom with you. You shouldn't have left it at the front door. You shouldn't have checked it at the closet. You should still have it with you, and that's called your common sense. And it's no rocket science to being a juror. You don't have to have training. You use your common sense, and you bring that in the room. And as far as the pressure and acquiescing, what I tell jurors, if I think that's going to happen, I pick out one juror when I'm selecting them, and it's usually the church mama type, someone that's outspoken, and I say, you know, Ms. Jones, if it's, you know, midnight, and 11 people think he's guilty, but you think he's not guilty, are you going to cave in or are you going to hold out? She goes, I'm going to hold out. And so I do that in my jury selection to make sure, because always one of them wants to remember what I said, and they'll be the holdout if they really remember that. You know, but unfortunately, sometimes people cave in, but most jurors are going to speak their mind. But if you have to remember, the makeup of this jury, and I don't know what it was, but I'm just, you know, making an assumption here that if the white members of that jury believed that he was justified and the black women on that jury said, no, he kept shooting, you're going to have a stalemate. I mean, there's nothing you can do. And it's something called the Allen charge. When the jury cannot come to a decision, they come back out to the judge and say, hey, we can't come to a decision. And he said, well, go back in there and do it again. And if they can't do it, then they have to do a mistrial. So I think that these jurors tried to work hard. They did their civic duty, but somebody believed Michael Dunn and somebody didn't believe him, and that's why they, you know, came to a hung jury.
Thank you very much. I need to bring in some panelists that have been waiting to come in, so just a second, okay? Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air. Hello?
Are you talking to me?
Okay, I guess I am. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, this is Kevin from Staten Island.
All right, 1 second, and you'll be first up on the queue. Let me bring in the panelist behind you. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Hello, I don't know what to say because everybody...
One second.
All my questions were being answered, you know.
Okay. Welcome to the show, caller. You on the air?
Hello, KD.
Okay, yeah. Hold on, Tariq. You'll be next up, okay?
Okay.
Okay, Kevin, what were you saying?
I was just wondering because, you know, I can see the difference between attempted murder and second-degree murder. But I'm just wondering, did this guy get a psych evaluation, or is this guy mentally capable of having a gun? On the way he acted.
Carl, you can take that one.
Okay, can you repeat that question again?
Okay, I'm reading the story now, and I can see the difference between first-degree murder and second-degree murder. And based on the way this guy acted with the gun, I'm surprised they don't give him a psych evaluation because maybe he's not mentally qualified to have a gun.
Well, actually, I guess that would be for the attorney, Mr. Foote.
Yeah, if I can, Kevin. There's no evidence of whether or not they gave him a psych evaluation or not, but you bring up an interesting point. When I was reading his statements in those letters, he wrote those handwritten letters, it appeared to me that he's a little bit off his rocker, the way he talks. So that is a good question. But this man is not a resident of Florida. He was down here for a wedding. I think he came from Maryland, and he had a concealed weapons permit from Maryland. So he was visiting, staying in a bed and breakfast, waiting to go to a wedding or so. He was visiting our state. He's not a resident. And he commented that, you know, he didn't like the people in Jacksonville and making all kinds of statements. So I guess you would have to ask the state of Maryland, whether or not he should have had a concealed weapons permit.
Can I ask you one more question?
Okay.
Hello? Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I'm listening to all the points and everything as far as how law is structured and stuff like that is good. But then look at it from, you know, the way things in life are. You know, you have rules of court and how they go about things and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, you coming in there as people. There's no robot on these juries. And for the most part, historically, when something like this has went down, either the people who picked us up as far as police or whatever, if they felt like they wanted to come across in a certain way to make us, you know, be demonized or however, you know, most of the time they succeeded in doing that. And the way that things are happening now, and I've been telling people for a while now, I said, these guns are flying off the shelves. It's not black people buying out these pawn shops and everything. And people, our people, I knew it already. I said, our people, I'm scared because our people are going to start getting shot down in the street.
That's what I'm saying. That's what's going on.
And I mean, what can you do in a system that you try to believe in because it's not really in totality, really all out our system? We're trying to buy into something that has sold us out from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trying to keep hope alive and all this type of stuff. But then they show you, as much as strides you make, we're going to show you, just like we've been showing you with Jim Crow and all the other things we resorted to in the past, we will throw curves in there on you when we get ready. And we getting hit from all sides. You see how they set up the jury. You see how most of the time when there's cases like that, the jury, as far as the people on the panel, they're not setting it up where it's truly our peers. You got these people that don't even understand our walks of life, our ways of life, and our culture for real, but they're judging us. And half of them, and both of them, be biased against us anyway.
Right.
It's a hard to win situation because nobody's really thinking with truth, justice, or fairness. They're thinking for stereotypical types of view when they come in, but making like they're not.
And that's exactly why they want to kill us, the black males. They want to kill us, the black men, because if we do live long enough to come to fruition, we will be the interpreter of laws. We have been the interpreter of laws in the past. Black people, we have always done it. And it's so sad because people, somebody was saying earlier, like back in the civil rights era, during a time when we introduced the children, people's hearts melted, and that's when hearts really got changed. Nowadays, people are so cold, so disgustingly, filthily cold, that they can see a child be murdered and feel nothing. That's crazy. Yeah. They dehumanize our children in such a way that a child means nothing to them anyway. And you know, the child wants, even when they were killing us in the streets, for real, they cared about the children. And nowadays, they that desensitized. That's absolutely out of control. We sitting here, we still putting the plan around when, at the end of the day, I hear what's being said, that the charges stand if there is no appeal. I see an appeal coming. I've seen this type of thing happen, and without anything racially being involved. A person could take an appeal, maybe acquit 2 to 3 of the charges. Maybe could break it down to one charge. It's possible if there is an appeal. So this is what they're trying to build towards. He's trying to build a foundation to actually spit in our face. You understand? You know,
well,
I can tell you
with regard to appeals, it's very hard to overturn a case, black or white. From my experience, I, as a defense attorney, I have people doing time now, and we do appeals. It has to be something major. Okay, they don't, in the appeals court, they don't hear testimony
like
again.
Like for instance.
Let Ken finish. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, Ken.
The appeals process, the appeals court, three judges sit and read the transcript and see if someone did something procedurally wrong. They don't get to go over testimony and say, well, we don't believe this lady. That's for the trial judge, who can look in the person's face and see if they're squirming, if they're lying. The appeals court is for procedural things. If the prosecutor did something wrong, okay, if the judge made a wrong ruling, you know, if the judge allowed some evidence in that was inappropriate, then they will send the case back to be retried. They don't just throw the case out. It has to be retried again.
Mm-hmm.
So I doubt that that's going to really happen. They don't like to upset jury verdict. But from what Nicole was saying, there's a big issue that we kind of skip, and this goes kind of into another issue, is the mental illness issue. Many people in Florida carry guns. I'm a gun owner. I have guns. I've always had guns. But guns don't kill people. It's the people behind it. And so when you hear in the national news that we need to have some type of checklist to make sure you're psychologically okay to carry a gun, then the NRA goes crazy and they start pumping money into the state to fight it. I agree. When you have these people shooting up schools, and we had, and I know y'all heard about the shooting in the movie theater, the person threw popcorn at a guy. And this is a retired police officer shot and killed a man in the movie theater because he was texting on his phone and he felt threatened because the other guy threw popcorn at him. He pulled out his gun and shot and killed him. So
you see that stand around and stand there.
Well, he's going to try. That's going to be some mental defense that something was wrong with him probably or whatever. But they're trying to self-defense that he was in fear of his life. And that gets to my point. Is what is a reasonable standard? If I throw popcorn at you, is that going to kill you? Do you need to pull your gun out? I mean, come on.
Well, it's not
going to
stand because of the person that's involved. It was a 45-year-old white male. So,
correct. You
know, right then and there, nobody's trying to hear that self-defense argument.
Is the word assailant ever used in the language of stand your ground?
In Dallas, last summer, July, where there was a Asian of Asian descent, Pacific Islander descent man who owns a shopping center, and for Valentine's Day of last year, a couple of different entrepreneurs who normally sold their goods from the shopping center parking lot pulled up. And there was a woman of that entrepreneur group who had gotten a license, a peddler's license. There was also a brother and his wife. They only had 20 baskets pulled up, and the woman questioned, "Do you have a license?" Of course, no, they didn't. She called the police. The police came, talked to the people. The people let them go ahead and sell their couple of baskets, let them be gone. Well, in the meantime, the woman called the owner of the shopping center, who was a specific officer person. He comes up there and starts mouthing off to the brother, and the brother said, "Well, the police has already been here. They said I could stay here and sell my couple of baskets. Leave me alone." The Pacific Islander man kicked the man's basket and started yelling and screaming at him. And it was a brother about maybe 6'2". And when the brother went to, you know, retort back to him, he pulled out a pistol and shot into the air. Well, he went to trial. The police came again, and the police arrested the Pacific Islander man, and when it went to court, he was found not guilty. The brother took him to civil court, though, and the judge found him $5,000 liable for shooting a gun at this man who was not menacing him. And the Pacific Islander man said the same thing. "I was in fear for my life." Whatever. It's like, that's going to be the mantra. That's how they're going to kill us.
Exactly.
That's how they're going to kill
us. Exactly. And you know, when...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but the time is coming in and time is winding down, so I need to bring them in. Hold on 1 second. Welcome to the show, Corey. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Hi, who am I speaking with?
This is Bianca Town from the Midwest.
Yes, how are you?
You know.
What is the name? What is the name? I expect the name.
Pianchi. I don't think that this thing, but I hear folks saying this is how they're going to kill us. I don't think that has any validity. I think what we need to have.
It's delusional.
Well, who's going to kill you? You know, blacks in Florida use stand your ground more often than their proportions to the population in that state. And you have had blacks to use stand your ground to shoot whites. You have had black women to use stand your ground to shoot black men. So, I tell you, if people don't, you know, blacks are the least likely to answer a jury summon, if I'm not mistaken.
What?
Than anybody else. That's the fact.
What?
We need to answer those jury summons and serve on those juries.
What?
Another point.
You're right.
Another thing. There's nothing wrong with concealed carry. Matter of fact, I think there should be open carry in every state if it's possible. But the point is that some states, you know, you got a city right outside of Atlanta, Kissimmee, and Nelson, where it's required that you have a gun, especially in Kissimmee. They're not enforced in Nelson, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. In Kissimmee, the population, the ethnic population of blacks in the city is like 20%.
He's kind of he's breaking up. Yeah.
50%?
It's about 59% Hispanic, about 20%, 12% black, and the rest is white.
You're breaking up, white
Pianchi. Yeah, you're breaking up.
Well, I'm sorry, but as I was saying before, I don't think that nobody's out trying to kill you. More blacks that qualify should be concealed carry. I just think if those young men in there were concealed carry in that truck, you think the guy would have shot him in? Oh, you would have been reluctant to. And no, I don't like the way the outcome came, but based on the facts, I guess that's the outcome that they came up with. The man's going to spend 60 years in jail. And I don't think an appeal is going to get him out of that.
Well, brother, the precedent.
What?
The precedent. The precedent behind the necessity for him to be actually convicted of the first degree was to stop the next Jordan Davis from occurring. I'm not sure if you paid attention, but another brother was just shot 2 days ago. Oh, was it? I'm sorry, today's Monday, so he was shot yesterday. Another brother was just shot yesterday running through somebody's yard because his pants were too low. You know, so far, that's the news that we have so far. So the precedent is what's important. And I did a lecture about the Trayvon Martin incident back on August 10th. Katie, we have an interview, the very first interview that we did on your show a few months ago. And we talked about the fact that this is a precedent-setting case where people see this case and then mock the behaviors of George Zimmerman, mock the behaviors of Michael Dunn. And that is the issue. That is the issue that we're trying to discuss. And how do we address those issues to stop the next ones from occurring?
Well, if I can, Professor, I'm in agreement with you, and so we need to talk about solving the issue, and that comes from the grassroots. The caller from the Midwest had said something about, you know, jury summonses and people coming out of it. Unfortunately, he has some accuracy there. We get outraged when something happens, but when it's time for us to step up and come out and vote and organize, unfortunately, we don't do that. We just come out when we're outraged. But we have to get into the legislative process. We have to get involved. We have to be able to change the laws and go ahead and vote and do something about it. And that's kind of the problem. If we can come out and change the laws, we can come out and organize. But unfortunately, we don't do it until something happens. And in a few weeks, you're not going to hear about Jordan Davis. In a few weeks, you know, you're not going to hear about Trayvon Martin. It's just going to be a few people that are holding on to it. But people move on because this is a 24-hour news cycle. They're going to go on to the next story. And so we have to be there. We got to be dug in. We got to be committed on all levels to stand up and to do something about changing the laws. And that comes into a problem where you have big businesses, big organizations coming in, spending millions of dollars. They're not even from Florida. But we have a governor's race coming up. The governor is going to run again, Rick Scott. And he's going to run against Charlie Crist, who used to be the governor and turned from Republican to Democrat. And not to get political on it, but they're going to spend a lot of money here because they want Rick Scott to stay in there because he – like the NRA. He pushes forward for the gun laws. These politicians that are elected in our state legislature are taking this gun lobby money. And so they're going to do everything they can so they can continue to sell guns down here and do what they need to do. But I still go back to the issue that before you issue a gun, you should have some type of check. We do more checks to get a driver's license than we do to carry a gun.
Look, can I ask you a question?
I don't think that's...
Why do we always pinpoint the NRA? The NRA is an organization. The NRA is an organization whose members are United States citizens who feel threatened that their Second Amendment rights given to them by the United States Constitution is going to be diluted. The same way the NAACP has members who they champion for.
I disagree.
So why don't we say you got United States citizens, United States citizens who want to keep their Second Amendment rights.
Pianchi, let me ask you a question. Pianchi, is it not true that the NRA was established in the exact same year as the Ku Klux Klan? Is that not true?
Well, a lot of things was established during that
true,
Ku Klux Klan came along.
Also, one of the founding members, was he not also a member of the Ku Klux Klan, also founded in that year? Is that not true?
Yeah, what does this got to do with it?
That's all I need to say. That's all I need to say, sir.
Okay.
It's self-explanatory.
I think one of the reasons why the NRA
Okay, all right, hello, hello. We don't normally have this behavior on the panel, so let's wait out each other's turn. I believe why the NRA is so important is because NRA believes in bearing arms, exactly, true indeed. But usually they're bearing arms, and the reason why everybody's so up in arms about that right being taken away is because they're the first set of people that will shoot first and ask questions later.
Well, I'm not a member of the NRA, but if somebody threatened me, I'm going to shoot them.
Right.
Well,
and that's the whole point, though. That's the whole point at this moment. The Stand Your Ground law is being taken into a whole different level, and it's usually going against African Americans. That's what the whole point is.
And that is a fact.
Well, African Americans stand to gain more. African American women, especially elderly women, stand to gain more from Stand Your Ground. It was Castle Law. Then they said that, well, a person that leave their house should have the same protection as they do in their house. So it became Stand Your Ground.
And in that respect, and explain why all of these African American cases who were under the Stand Your Ground protection law didn't get the same legal treatment.
Then that's that should be a discussion.
You guys
explain
have to understand that
a young woman. Why is there a young woman who had a legal right to sit there and defend herself from a criminal that is listed a criminal by a restraining order in a court of law who shot in the air, not even as a terror attacker, in the air? And not only did she get immediately convicted for 20 years, and that this judge clearly said your point of self-defense is not valid, which makes no sense to me. However, they didn't give her, based on the Zimmerman trial or whatever, a dismissal. They said she has to go through this trial all over again.
Well, she left and came back.
I guess she wasn't a part of the NRA, that's why.
Well, let me tell you, that young lady.
I'm going to tell you something. I hear black people making these remarks, but you know, there was a time when a white man would never stand trial for killing a black person. Here's another point.
Correct.
We want to change the sentiment. We want to change the sentiment. Can I speak? Can I speak, please? Now, as I was saying once before, study the history of Florida as it applies to the Seminole Wars, Goldsboro, Florida, and Sanford County. Then you can understand why those people had the sentiments that they had. You know, during the Seminole War, blacks killed a whole bunch of whites down in Florida.
Goldsboro,
you had black men stand up against the Klan on Broadway Avenue, which they should have done with guns.
What's up?
Now, you made a comment, Bianchi, that said that there was once a time that whites wouldn't even stood trial. Now, what does that say in turn? That says that because it's almost like this Jordan Davis conviction, you know? Well Zimmerman got off all together. All that I am speaking, whoever that is. Now, Zimmerman got off altogether, and we were upset about that. And what are we saying now? That this little conviction for Jordan Davis's killer, because of that, we should be happy that he didn't get a conviction on what he actually did? I'm speaking, sir. Okay, because he's out there, and because he's getting jail time, you know, like you guys should be happy. That's the way it's appearing. That's the way it's appearing. And Kenneth, you made a perfect point. We do get reactionary when things happen after the outbreak has happened. We don't sit there and say, oh, not just come out whenever there's a historical black person in office, or in an office that never would have been a black person's option. We don't get proactive. We get reactive, and that is a problem because this is the type of stuff that continues to happen. What has to happen? We have to continue losing our black teenagers. Our black women have to go to jail away from their babies because of the fact that somebody out there doesn't like our skin color, and because the people whose skin color they don't like aren't talking, we gotta lay back and take it. That is the wrong mentality, and that's never going to bring change. And I agree with you, Ken, 100%. And by the way,
is that prosecutor elected position?
Yes.
Well, why come nobody voting her out?
Well, we got to go to a voting poll. We traditionally don't like to go and vote. Unless the president
right,
we came out in record numbers. But when it comes to getting out and voting, unfortunately, and I'm not saying everybody, but we don't show up to the polls. I mean,
why don't we have
about
5,000 blacks move in that county and then vote her out? I've seen Jews do that before. They've got Cynthia McKinney out of Georgia.
Oh, boy.
We like to complain and say white folks hate us and they're going to kill us. Well, the prosecutor done a terrible job with Zimmerman, I think. And
well, let me tell you, Jacksonville is not a small town. It's not a small town. There's plenty of black folks there. Plenty of black folks there in Jacksonville. But they've got to go to the polls. You know, and you got to support each other. And we have this tendency where we don't want to support people, or we don't come correct with our game. When there's a good candidate out there, we don't come out and support. We are not advised, and we don't know what's going on in the political process.
Right.
Whoever
and
that is, would you please be respectful?
It's almost echo.
Thank you. I would appreciate it if you control your background noise.
You are absolutely correct, Kenneth. We don't come out. And you are absolutely correct that the town of Jacksonville has plenty of African Americans. My grandmother lived there for years.
Plenty.
And that is one of the problems that we speak about that on previous segments here. One of the problems with our community is that we don't protect our own community. Now, in that respect, and with that being said, and that's a fact being known, let's still get back to this legal system, okay? Get back to the legal system.
Yeah.
Many things that we see makes absolutely no sense. There's no reason that can be listed under tactical strategy or anything to that effect, because I'm going to tell you something. When somebody gets out of their car and shoots at a retreating car 17 times and then be able to walk in and say, I was in fear for my life, that leads to the question, who the hell's buying this garbage?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
apparently these jurors bought that, and
they did.
Bring up another point that Professor was talking about. The only crime the highest charge was first-degree murder. But in Florida, as in many other states, there's something called lesser included. So if you don't believe the prosecutor proved the top charge of first-degree murder, there's a list of other charges underneath that they could have found them guilty of, like second-degree murder or manslaughter. And that's where I'm confused, that they skipped through all of that and said they were hung on. I mean, there's a dead kid here.
Hold on a second. Somebody with that background noise, would you please clear it up, please? It's very disrespectful.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
I mean, this jury could have come back with one of the lesser charges, like second-degree murder or manslaughter, and so they skipped. They had a verdict form, and that verdict form had all the crimes on it, and they skipped all of them and couldn't come to anything. That's where I'm a little confused. Okay, maybe you don't think it was premeditated murder. That's a hard charge to prove, okay? But you had a whole lot of other choices, so this jury could not come to an agreement on any of those for Jordan Davis.
Yes.
Why no hate crime? Why no hate crime introduced?
Right.
Why is that never introduced? And another thing, why is it that doesn't Stand Your Ground omit you of any burden of civil liability or criminal? So that means if he was to get Stand Your Ground on one of those counts, they couldn't sue for like wrongful death or anything or get any money or anything like that.
No, that's incorrect. You can sue him. You can sue him in a civil courtroom if you want. The issue is whether or not he got any money. I mean, you saw what happened with O.J.
On Stand Your Ground, it says something else.
Yeah, the criminal case is one thing, but civil, if you take someone's life, okay, the standard is very much lower in a civil case, but the issue is whether he got any money or not. That's how they got O.J. They didn't get him on the crime, but they got him on the civil case. So they can do whatever they want if they want to do that. But I watch these parents on TV, and they're going to be on MSNBC on Wednesday night on one of the shows. And these were very respectful people. And what I picked up from them, which we should be talking about, is how do we solve this problem? How do we move on from here and not just be outraged, okay? The cable shows are picking this up because they want ratings, but when the new story comes out, they're going to forget about Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin. So we, as citizens, have to figure out what do we do to keep this conversation relevant, and how do we start a relevant discussion with other people? All of this about racism, as we all know, is about ignorance. It's about misconceptions and perceptions about a certain group. So we need to sit down to the table, starting from the top. They're giving our president a hard time. You know, African-American in the White House. They don't want him there. So it goes from the top all the way down. He went to the best school, did the right thing, and they still won't give this man respect. You think they're going to give some kid in the street some respect when they don't respect the president? Come on.
The thing I have with this is who we are targeting, sitting down talking with white folks. White folks are not killing black folks. Black males are not being killed to the number. Black males across this country are not being killed by whites. They're being killed by their own. And one thing that could be done down there is sit down and talk with those young children and tell them what's going on.
Can you pick up from where that interference or background noise is coming from and mute them?
Deacon, I think that's an echo.
Somebody got the computer up.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take a short break. I want everybody to adjust their phones. I don't want anybody over speakerphones without another. If you're listening to the broadcast via computer and calling in, one has to go down, okay? I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
jeez. Did they say what they said?
Tonight.
Now, back with more On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge show with Katie Bonet and friends. Okay, we are in the middle of a very intriguing discussion about the Michael Dunn verdict in the Jordan Davis murder trial. And we have tonight a special guest, former Florida prosecutor Kenneth Foote. You guys have heard him in our sponsor commercials. And he's absolutely offering some awesome advice, as well as all of our panelists tonight, and Professor Carl Tom Jones, who had to leave us, but he also was offering some great input from his side of the fence. So we're bringing our panelists and our guests back in one at a time. One second. Hi, Kenneth, are you back?
Yes, I am.
All right, thank you very much. Hang on just a second. Deacon, are you back?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay, DC?
I'm here.
All right, Stalo?
I'm here, and excuse me for earlier.
Okay.
I'm here.
All right. Al-Tariq? Al-Tariq?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And Bianchi, are you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. All right. So, Kenneth, you know, as we were speaking about, it's a matter of, like, you know, no one coming out really to vote to make a change. So what do you think that we can now have, we could have? I'm sorry, Ken, what were you saying?
You broke up, Katie. What was the question?
Oh, the question was, how can we start to make a change in this? And I believe that more than likely it's taken it to the legislative level, and which would, of course, have to be through the politicians we elect in. So will you feel that that will be our first step?
Well, we need to get organized. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I live in Tampa, Florida. And I can tell you honestly, I didn't hear much about this Jordan Davis case. I knew it was going on. It was off and on. I learned about it on the national news media with, you know, Reverend Sharpton on MSNBC and people talking about it. And what tends to happen with these cases, and I can tell you how Floridians look at it, I mean, you might have people protesting outside the courthouse, okay, locally. But the rest of the state is just going on about its business. And so you look at the news and see what's going on. Unfortunately, you have a lot of the cable news media that tends to use this as a reason to either boost their ratings or whatever. And, you know, you have the other side saying, oh, here they go with the race thing again. But as I tell people, race is the 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody wants to talk about. And at some point, we need to sit down at the table and have a discussion about this, because most of this comes down to just ignorance on the part of everybody, black, white, everybody. We need to sit down and talk and see that we are not that different. You know, there's always going to be your right-wing, you know, scary people out there that just, you know, want to live back in the old days. But we need to all sit down and talk about it. As far as our community, I think locally on the grassroots level, that we need to organize and commit our time, and then you have to deal with the legislature. You have to go up and vote the people you want in. You got to be educated about the issues. You know, we don't turn on the news until we hear something going on or we look on Facebook. You have to be plugged in all the time to see who the movers and shakers are, who's coming into our state bringing money in, you know, who's doing what to kind of, you know, influence the process, not just cry out when there's, you know, a little boy in a casket. This has to be a constant conversation that's coming on. So here in Florida, I mean, we need to address our legislature. We need to come out and vote. You know, as you know, when I was in New York and both down here, you don't see politicians. They come to your church a week before the election. That's the only time they might say in the church. They stand up in the pulpit and say, hi, my name is so-and-so, vote for me. No one ever comes back. We got to hold these people accountable. Don't just come here on election week. You know, come here periodically and have some town hall meetings to talk about the issues of what is going on. you know. And as far as gun violence, I mean, again, we don't really talk about the black-on-black violence. We don't get outraged when a brother kills a brother. You know, but when there's a white face behind the trigger, we go nuts. And so they ask us, well, why are they getting jumpy when a white person kills them? But they don't talk about it when we kill each other over a cell phone or a jacket or some sneakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
So we got some homework to do in our community.
Yes,
so
we do.
Got a lot of
desensitized
people, man. But my ears go off when I hear child murder. If I hear juvenile, the minor, if I hear 18, 19, 20, 21, I go off because I understand what that age meant for me, and I understand how every move is dire for a man that's always under aware assault by the society he lives in. This is some real stuff that's going on. And at the end of the day, we got to arm our youth at this point. Now we got to arm our youth with legal knowledge beforehand and above all things. Like, that's what they fear anyway. They fear black men reaching the age of becoming their judges, you know what I'm saying, their fathers. You understand what I mean? Like having authority over them at all. And that is what they're most offended by. And see, they are most offended by any black man having equal authority as them or authority over them. They hate it. It's a pain in their gut. And anybody who's listening that hates that, yeah, you have a pain in your gut. And that pain in your gut is a bigoted, racist way. Now, who it applies to, sit and lay in that shoe and because it stinks, you know, and climb out whenever you get ready because it doesn't even really matter.
Okay, I do have to cut you, and I want to let Professor, who I thought was going to leave us, but he's back. I have 6 minutes left, so Professor, weigh in on your final remarks.
Well, where do I begin? I agree that we need to be more active, and as always, you know, I always say we need to put more feet in the ground, do more walking than talking. And if some of you had a chance to see, I posted a video recently in regards to this Jordan Davis murder trial.
Yeah.
And I posted several videos, actually, because I wanted to boost awareness of this trial because no one was talking about it. Specifically, nobody in our community was talking about it. What made me more upset was that nobody seemed to care until the case, until the actual verdict was imminent. Nobody seemed to care. And it really angered me because I'm in a lot of social network groups all over the country, and I'm in some in Florida. And the groups in Florida in particular chose to ignore this particular case, from my opinion, from what I saw, based on the people who I'm in touch with in Florida. And that is very, very, that really drove me up a wall because nobody's going to fix this except for us. Nobody's going to fix this situation. So until we get active, until we can say we're not getting turned up anymore, until we can start organizing, and I put the pledge out there that we need to organize Saturday morning meetings the same way they do in the Jewish community, have Saturday morning meetings where we have operant think tanks put together plans to organize and mobilize the community for political, business, commerce, and social means and educational means for whatever we need to do in order to get our community back up and running. And we need to also develop a code of conduct and a code of ethics that we prescribe to so that we can address situations like this. There's no reason as to why we shouldn't have known this case was coming up, and we couldn't have put pressure on the Florida legislature to handle this case in a specific way. Each and every time there's an opportunity, and I specifically believe Angela Corey has an agenda because she specifically publicizes how they're taking race out of all of these judicial cases that are coming up and every single prosecution that's coming up down there. And just like the attorney said, when we talk about race, but when we don't talk about race, we're still injecting race into every conversation. We're still injecting race into every situation. So, you know, we have to understand the code word for deflection, because when we don't talk about race, now all of a sudden it's an absence of responsibility. We're not making anybody accountable to deal with us.
Right.
Oh, thank you very much, Professor.
Excellent.
A few minutes. I want to thank
every single one of you for your input tonight, for your feedback, for your contributions. Definitely want to thank Mr. Kenneth Foote and, of course, always you, Professor, for your input and your contributions and the support. We definitely have to start opening our eyes, our mouths, and using our marching power, not our clicking power on Facebook. Facebook and social media activism does nothing. Does nothing. Nothing at all whatsoever for change. Does nothing for positive reinforcement. Does nothing to save our children from racism, from laws that's based on ignorance, from people who have perceived power. It does nothing, absolutely. And while we are sitting up there grumbling about it from behind the scenes, our children are being killed on the front page. So if we don't start doing something about it right this minute, if we don't start using what we have in our hand and stop complaining about what we don't have, and get out there, and like you said, Ken, if you can, well, okay, Ken's not with us, but he said, you'll see these politicians the week before the election, whoever is doing that, please stop. We will see these politicians 1 week before the election. We'll get emails from them with a personal first name basis, and we'll never see them again. We need to hold them accountable all the way through. Whatever we don't like, we need to make a stink about and use that same unity we have when a black politician is coming in to unity against other things. So until tomorrow night, everybody, be blessed.
Hello?
Hello?
I think our mic cut out.
Yes, 1 minute, 30 seconds.
Yeah. On the Edge, real talk about real issues.